there's a lot of tradecraft that has to get unlearned as well. You know, Warzone tradecraft is not real tradecraft.
So if you have someone who speaks a language, who's a skilled interrogator, do that battlefield interrogation, capitalize on shock of capture at the point of capture, you can get a lot out of it. But I've also seen intel fail to live up. They can't keep up physically. They're not delivering on the battlefield. They're too slow. They're too timid. And that has a bad effect on the entire intel process.
Welcome to episode 104 of the Irregular Warfare Podcast. I'm your host, Louis Tuberky, and I'll be joined by my co-host, Julia McLennan. Today's episode focuses on intelligence support to irregular warfare.
Our guests begin with an overview of the history of the CIA and the development in intelligence capabilities throughout the global war on terror, and then they discuss ways that intelligence professionals can partner most effectively with other organizations. Finally, they close with a discussion about the future of intelligence collection.
Lieutenant Colonel retired Charles Faint currently serves as the chair for the study of special operations at the Modern War Institute at West Point, and as an assistant professor in the Defense and Strategic Studies program. He holds 6 advanced degrees, and prior to his academic career, he served as an infantry officer in the 101st Airborne Division before switching to the Military Intelligence Corps, where he served in the 2nd Infantry Division, the 5th Special Forces Group, the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and the Joint Special Operations Command.
Dr. David Geo is an associate professor of history at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where he serves as a history fellow for the Army Cyber Institute. David is also the director of studies for the Cambridge Security Initiative. Before starting his academic career, David was an intelligence officer, first at the FBI, working on economic espionage and counterterrorism, and later in the CIA as both an analyst and operations officer on multiple continents. He has served as a Naval Reserve officer, as both an intelligence and foreign area officer. He recently co-edited Great Power Cyber Competition, Competing and Winning in the Information Environment, with IWI's Maggie Smith. His article, The More Things Change, Human in the Cyber Era, serves as the anchor for today's conversation.
You are listening to the Irregular Warfare Podcast, a joint production of the Princeton Empirical Studies of Conflict Project and the Modern War Institute at West Point, dedicated to bridging the gap between scholars and practitioners to support the community of irregular warfare professionals. Here's our conversation with Charlie Faint and Dave Geo. Charlie and Dave, welcome to the Irregular Warfare Podcast.
Louis, so glad to be here with you and Julia. Big fan of IWI and first time on the show, so thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, what Charlie said. Thanks for the invitation.
Excellent. So, Dave, we mentioned in your intro that you've spent some time working at the Central Intelligence Agency. Can you give our audience a brief overview of some of the historical links between the CIA, the U.S. Special Operations Forces, and irregular warfare?
I thought I would start just by saying a little bit about me. Before I came to academia, I spent almost a decade at CIA in both analytical and operational roles, which is a bit of a unicorn. But one of the highlights of my career was spent as a CIA liaison officer working with Joint Special Operations Command for a few years in the Middle East. And one of my jobs was to serve as a sort of belly button or a coordination officer between JSOC and the CIA station. And I came to really admire the flexibility and the sort of mission-oriented nature of the operators that I had the pleasure of working with. But enough about me. To your question about the historical links. Yeah, I mean, the history of U.S. intelligence and special operations, and I think the intersection between the two, actually dates right back to the founding of America, when General Washington needed troops for intelligence missions to collect information about the disposition of British forces in the colonies. We'd now sort of understand that to mean reconnaissance more than intelligence. So the word has changed over time. But in fact, there's a statue of the brave but relatively bad intelligence officer, a guy called Captain Nathan Hale, outside of CIA headquarters. And Hale answered Washington's call for an intelligence mission to go undercover into British-occupied New York City, and was unfortunately quickly discovered and executed by the British, age 21. Obviously, CIA wants its officers to have better tradecraft than the doomed Captain Hale, but he serves as an inspiration, I think, for his willingness to put up his hand, a very biblical, here I am, send me approach. But just speeding up closer to our own time, I think it's worth mentioning the other major military statue at CIA headquarters, which is, of course, of General William, quotes, Wild Bill Donovan. And his World War II era Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, was a sort of proto paramilitary intelligence, sabotage, and special operations force. Donovan was a brilliant visionary, an energetic leader, but not really a great manager. But he did say memorably that he wanted his OSS officers to be Harvard PhDs who could handle themselves in a bar fight. Across the lobby from CIA's famous Stars on the Wall and the Book of Honor, which commemorates CIA's fallen officers, there's a book with the names of fallen OSS officers and men, although there was, of course, no such thing when those people served the country. There was no such thing as CIA. The final thing I wanted to mention on this point about the historical links is that both Special Operations Command and CIA consider General Donovan to be the father, or maybe even the sort of godfather, of their respective organizations. And you'll be familiar with the CIA crest, the famous one with the shield and the compass rose and the eagle on it. But CIA's Directorate of Operations has its own lesser known crest, which has the same spear that SOCOM uses, and it's the same spear from the OSS patch. So Charlie, you guys actually stole that, but we forgive you. It's impossible to sort of overstate how important Donovan was in CIA's own founding mythology. At its headquarters, CIA has a long hallway with a bunch of portraits called the Director's Gallery, which obviously has the portraits of all the directors of Central Intelligence in it. And the first painting is actually of General Donovan, although he was never a DCI. So CIA decided to fudge this history so that the organization doesn't have to look back to the rather more forgettable Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers as their founding father.
Excellent, Dave. Thank you for that history. Charlie, did you want to follow up on that at all?
I just wanted to reinforce what Dave was saying, the close tie, especially the origin between the CIA and the special operations community. And it goes deeper than just the image that I just learned that we borrowed from CIA and OSS with the spear. So on many of my deployments, we worked very closely with the CIA and any number of other intelligence agencies, both on the regular warfare front, special operations, and conventional warfare. So just going into this conversation, I'd just like to say I appreciate the teamwork that we enjoyed through both the military and the civilian side of Intel. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Excellent. Thanks so much. So, Charlie, you spent a lot of time working at tactical and operational levels as a military intelligence officer in the Army. Can you give our audience an overview of the development of operations and intelligence fusion throughout the past 20 years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if Dave's experience is going to be similar to mine. But Julia, to me, the biggest change is in terms of capability. So I came into the Army under the Branch Detail Program, and I commissioned in 1995. So when we consider what tactical intel could bring to the table back then, it was actually very little. When I was an infantry officer in the 101st Airborne Division, it seemed to me that all the intel folks did was hand out maps and check arms rooms. And they got yelled at when the USR stats were wrong. USR is the unit status report. So it was pretty lame. And when we went to the field, the intel shop had to chiefly rely on templating, which was really just the best guess about where the bad guys were going to be and what they're going to do. And they almost always guessed wrong because they had very little experience themselves, both on the ground and at Fort Campbell itself. And other than the scout platoon, the intel team had almost no assets to get after their mission with. So there was no drone support, access to classified systems were extremely limited, and you had almost certainly no real-time imagery coming into your battalion-level command post. So usually the battalion commander in the S3, the operations officer, with the benefit of having a great deal of tactical-level experience, having been at the installation longer, were usually far better at estimating both enemy composition and disposition. So they expected and received very little from their intel shops. Of course, that all changed as the intel branch became more capable. Advances in technology and doctrine spread up the intel process enormously, and we started to be able to actually do things for commanders. So now, instead of just saying that intel drives operations in modern warfare, especially when it applies to irregular warfare, we find intel truly driving operations. I think that's the biggest difference, Julia.
Great. Thank you so much, Charlie.
So, Charlie, throughout your career, intel capabilities vastly improved while much of the U.S. military focused on the global war on terror instead of on conventional war or great power competition. So building upon those ideas and upon some of your writings on the targeting process, also called F3EAD for find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze, and disseminate, do you think the lessons learned in intelligence throughout the global war on terror are transferable to great power competition or not?
Well, 100% transferable. Targeting is targeting, doctrine is doctrine, intel cycle is intel cycle. I think largely it's a matter of application and a matter of convincing folks to use this. What was interesting to me, Louis, especially when we started promoting F3 EAD, which was largely developed inside JSOC, although certainly not exclusive to it, and I don't think we came up with it, we just expounded upon it. It was to get other people to accept and use the process. Part of it was because it was perceived as coming from the Intel, the special operations community. People didn't want to do that. They're like, oh, that's just something only JSOC could do. That's not true. Anybody could do F3 EAD. Anybody could be innovative. Anyone could exercise some discipline initiative, come up with new ideas, think creatively to get after these problems. So I think anybody can do it. I go back to another famous strategist, B.H. Liddell Hart, who said the only thing that's harder to get a new idea into a military mind is get an old idea out. So we have a lot of old ideas in there in our heads. A lot of them are good. So I think if we expose ourselves and accept new ways of thinking, we could take the Intel community a lot farther.
Yeah, I mean, just building on Charlie's point, number one, he mentioned B.H. Liddell Hart. And so Charlie got his alma mater of Yale in the conversation. So I'm going to now abuse the microphone and say that B.H. Liddell Hart was at Corpus Christi College, Cambridge. So we're even, Charlie. But no, on a more serious...
Well played.
Thank you, sir. On a more serious point, I mean, warfighter needs, you know, just looking through military history and the intersection with intelligence, warfighter needs... And frankly, Intel's failure to meet those needs actually really accounts for an awful lot of the sort of the driving of intelligence development. Two quick examples. You know, the first is famously SIGINT in Vietnam, where SIGINT just wasn't getting to the warfighter that needed it in time behind the proverbial green door. And so we knew things about the North Vietnamese Army, but we were unable to act on it because we couldn't get the intelligence downrange to the people who actually needed the warning or needed to be able to act on it. And then just moving to the first Gulf War, I'm reading General Jim Clapper's Facts and Fears right now, his memoir. And he really goes into some detail about his time trying to provide imagery intelligence to General Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War. And basically, Schwarzkopf was entirely unimpressed with the imagery effort. And so really, you know, that was a driving factor, you know, and so I think like so many things, failure to do the job leads to reflection and, hey, you know, how can we do this better?
Great points all around there, Dave. Thank you. So as a follow-up for Charlie, during the global war on terror, the exploitation step of the F3 EAD process often featured soldiers on the objective conducting sensitive site exploitation. What other methods of exploitation have worked for you when putting soldiers on or near the objective wasn't possible?
Hey, great question, Louis. Of course, on the ground is typically the best means of exploitation, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can exploit imagery intelligence. You can exploit measurements and systems analysis. You can exploit anything emanating from that site after you hit it. For example, if the target was a radio relay station, you don't necessarily need somebody on the ground there to establish that you've achieved the desired effects. For example, if you want it destroyed or if you want it just not broadcasting, you carry out whatever kinetic or non-kinetic event you want on it, then the exploitation and analysis of it, you realize that nothing's coming from that site anymore, so you've achieved a desired effect. So there's any number of ways that you can achieve the exploitation analysis and the dissemination aspect that happens after the actions on whatever it is that the commander decides to do against that target.
And then the other next portion of the F3 EAD is the analysis and then the dissemination. And often, I think we develop the capabilities to conduct that offsite as much as possible for the safety and security of the analysts who don't need to be anywhere near the objective. Do you think there is immense value in having analysts close to or having personal relationships with the folks on the operational side? Or is that just a nice to have that is totally unnecessary?
No, I think the closer you can have the entire effort to the actual objective is, generally speaking, a better way to do business. But it has to be the right intel people, Louis. It's got to be people that are steeped in the culture of the organization, that are physically fit, that are masters of their craft. They've got to have credibility with the operation folks. They've got to be able to provide something to them that is worth their, sometimes literally their weight, if you're considering aircraft, trying to move people around. They've got to be able to pull their own weight. They've got to be able to provide the right impact. So I've seen a lot of success come from folks who are signals intelligence operatives and get embedding with the operators and going on site with them. They can download whatever digital media is right there, exploit it instantly, and then go on to the next target almost immediately. Same with human forces. So if you have someone who speaks a language, who's a skilled interrogator, do that battlefield interrogation, capitalize on shock of capture at the point of capture, you can get a lot out of it. But I've also seen intel fail to live up. They can't keep up physically. They're not delivering on the battlefield. They're too slow. They're too timid. And that has a bad effect on the entire intel process. So bring it back to your original question. Yes, I think that would be a good way to do it. If you could have dedicated intel people freeing up the operators to do operator things, intel people do intel things, and you keep that virtuous circle going between ops and intel, I think you get a lot better effects.
Well, Charlie, I think you're right, but you neglected that the intel people should also be allowed to grow beards, but that's neither here nor there. I wanted to say something about debriefing, because I think really having the analysts around for debriefing is hugely beneficial. In my own career, Dave Geo doing the debriefing is, what do you have to say? I don't know. What do you want? What do you need to know? I don't know. And so having the analyst there, I can recall one personal story where we had an analyst come out, and the analyst basically just took pages and pages of notes asking really probing questions because he was a subject matter expert. And I basically just sat there and poured tea for people because the analyst was taking charge of that. And that was great. Nowadays, when we think, you know, especially in CIA, now we even have mission centers, right? What's that for? That's to put analysts and operations people as close together as humanly possible. But I was just thinking about, you know, it wasn't always that way, of course. And in fact, during the Bay of Pigs planning, for instance, the analysts at CIA had no idea that the Bay of Pigs, the invasion of Cuba with Cuban expatriates, was even going to happen. And afterwards, they were like, yeah, we could have told you that was never going to work. But the analysts were entirely cut out of the process. Another fun fact at CIA is that there used to be an armed guard between the operational elements and the analytical elements. And you'd think, oh, that's because you have to keep the analysts out of, like, you know, the cool operational planning. It's actually the opposite. The armed guard was to keep the operations people out because they were only read into their own programs, but the analysts were read into many more programs across a variety of compartments. And so in the old days, there was an armed guard, and there was even a separate bit of the cafeteria at CIA headquarters for people undercover to eat in. And so when we look at mission centers and how lashed up we are today, it's so remarkable when you think about how far we've actually come in the sort of the history of, at least of the intelligence community and CIA in particular.
Thank you both. What a fantastic conversation so far. So Charlie, we're going to pivot to you again. Can you tell us a sort of a twofold question? Can you tell us what enablers are? And as you've seen various U.S. Army units work with many different enablers throughout multiple deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, how did units employ enablers effectively, and where did you see friction?
Absolutely. Great question. So enabler is a difficult term to describe because I don't think it's been officially doctrinally explained in, like, in JP 1-02, the Dictionary of Doctrinal Terms. But an enabler is anyone who doesn't actively carry out the operational focus of an organization. So I am an enabler. I was an intel person supporting various special operations units. But there are some units that are specifically dedicated to intel. So they're out there. Their mission is intel gathering. So they're not enablers. They're carrying out the operational mission. Nonetheless, I think we can think of supported versus supporting is a good way to envision what enablers do. So in majority of my career, I supported the operational commander, supported his or her decision-making, gave them the information they needed to make operational assignments. And I helped enable the operation. That could be any number of things, from getting somebody paid to get them fed to helping them find the bad guys on the battlefield. And it's been interesting over time to see the evolution of how enablers are perceived and utilized, especially in the special operations community. So I got my start in special operations in the 5th Special Forces Group when I was a young captain. And it's interesting in special forces. I'm very grateful for my experiences in 5th Group. I had a great time there, commanded two companies there, got my first deployment, etc. But I think that the Special Forces Regiment will never be as good as it could be because they don't invest in their enablers. So Special Forces as a regiment, to the best of my knowledge, still true today, they don't have any type of robust selection, assessment, or training process for their enablers. So if you go to be a Green Beret like Louis, if you want to be Special Forces, there's this enormously selective and difficult, arduous training pipeline. You come out the other side, you got your Green Beret, you're ready to go, you're an extremely qualified person. There's no equivalent to that on the enabler side. It's a needs of your Army assignment. You can go to 10th Special Forces Group as easily as you could go to 10th Mountain Division. There are some exceptions to that. There are some organizations, some Group S2, some group commanders will get involved in the selection of their individual folks, but there's no robust program across the board. You compare that to places like the Ranger Regiment or 160th where I served or JSOC where I served. You got to try to be in those units. It's hard. They have a high level of expectation out of them. And that attracts a different type of soldier to those organizations. If you know you got to try out for it, that weeds out a certain number of non-hackers right off the bat. Plus, on the back end, when I got done with Green Platoon and reported to my battalion in the 160th, for example, I was accepted there in a way that I wasn't in 5th Group because I actually had to try out to be there. I did everything that the pilots did short of flying the helicopters, and JSOC largely the same way. So I think that's the biggest thing, the change that I've seen in the special operations community with regard to enablers, and the single biggest failing I still see in some organizations like Special Forces, who, again, I believe could never reach their full potential until they make an equal investment in their enablers.
Dave, I know you have not served in the Army per se, but you've been kind of as an outsider, as an enabler, or as an intelligence support, and other times you've been the main effort. Can you comment on being on both sides of that at times and places, what it's like to be on either side and how to best navigate that?
Yeah, I guess I'd put my Navy Reserve hat on. For a little over 22 years, I've been a reservist. And I think like Charlie, it's not really a great news story, if I'm honest, because a lot of Navy Reserve intelligence professionals are extraordinarily capable. And a lot of times they would get mobilized to JSOC or to some other special outfit. And they would basically get told, sit in the corner in color, and if we need you, we'll call you. And so I think just from a talent management point of view, I think we could really squeeze so much more capability out of these folks, at least on the Navy Reserve side. It's, hey, you are a full up round, right? You're qualified and you're going to go here. And they don't make any differentiations. They don't interview. They would probably be mad at me for saying this, but I don't see any real thought process or deliberation, right? They just pluck sailor who happens to have all of the boxes green and put them at place X. And so, I've seen a lot of people, unfortunately, a friend of mine, for instance, was a CIA military analyst, and she was brilliant. And for whatever reason, she just did not get on with her group. And many people had bad deployments, I think, because their talents were just entirely wasted. So, yeah, I agree with Charlie. And I think that's something that we could do a heck of a lot better to really maximize the potential out of people who, after all, it's an all-volunteer force, right? We want to serve. That's why we're here. So you might as well get the most out of us, especially as a reservist, because you can't mobilize a reservist. If you mobilize them for a year, then you have to rest them for 5, just in dwell. And so even me, I think I was relatively underutilized in my own deployment. And then I hit retirement eligibility with the Navy never being able to really use me for any of the skill sets that I had. And that's a personal frustration. So I do think we could do a lot better, both for the special operations units and also by the sailors, who at the end of the day, I think are very keen and willing and have a lot to offer.
Dave, that reminds me of at least the junior levels in the Foreign Service, where there seems to be no rhyme or reason beyond, are the correct boxes ticked to send you to country X? And oftentimes those boxes aren't things like cultural or language familiarity. You'll see people with years of language experience or cultural familiarity within a particular country get passed over for assignments there, but selected for something else just because they have some specific functional training box checked, regardless of their life experiences before joining up.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say, that sort of represents, when we talk about intelligence or we talk about special operations forces, I mean, we're really talking about American intelligence, right? The way we do it, because we often say intelligence to mean everything from Russian intelligence to Chinese intelligence to British to Israeli to whatever, right? We just use the word. And the national expressions of that word are so, so different. And I think for us, both in the intelligence community, in the law enforcement community, and in the foreign service, what you basically see is the sort of the worshiping at the altar of the generalist, where, yeah, I want to be able to drop a foreign service officer in Peru or in Japan or in Canada or in Kabul, and they're just supposed to like work. And that's the same view, I think, in CIA, right? You should be able to just drop a, you know, a fully trained, experienced case officer wherever in the world, and sort of it's fungible, right? They're all the same person and they'll just figure it out. And when I look at other countries, particularly the Brits, just because they're smaller, right? They just don't have the ability to not use resources in a smarter way. I'm here in London. My sort of day job is at King's College London at the moment. And when I work with the British MOD, they just can't afford to make a bunch of generalists. They just have to have people who are specialists in certain things. And so you can see that in their career trajectory. I mean, they have the classic T.E. Lawrence, the Arabist, who spent their entire career in the region and speaks a lot of different dialects of Arabic. Whereas from what I've seen, we teach somebody Arabic and then we send them to Doha or wherever. And then we send them, then we teach them Japanese and send them to Japan and lather, rinse, repeat. And so I think when we talk about intelligence, or I'll defer to you, to Charlie on special operations, the altar of the generalist, I think, is just the path that we've chosen. And I don't know if it's a deliberate path, if it's the right one, or if we're just not holding our assignments process to the level of deliberation that we ought to.
Dave, that's another great point. I was thinking when you were talking about the ways that intel works differently in different countries. My father was in Special Forces in the early days of SF before it was his own branch. So back when Dad was in Fifth Group, everyone wore their branch insignia on their collar, the branch that they came from. So in my father's case, it was military intelligence. And when he would go overseas to help train various forces, especially in the Middle East, because that's Fifth Group's mission, people would ask him what that insignia was, because it's pretty obvious what armor insignia is, or aviation or infantry, but we got the squashed bug of the rose and the sun and the dagger and everything else we got going on. It's very confusing. When Dad would tell them it was intel, they treated him very differently, because in the Shah of Iran times, the intelligence forces were the secret police. So intel does a lot of different things depending on where you go and what you're doing at the time. And I also like your example of the Brits. I worked very closely with the British. I had a UK deputy twice when I was with the task force in Iraq, and those were great individuals. I think a lot of times people forget how capable the U.S. intel system really is, because we are so large and because we have so much money. That's the reason we can do so much. Now, whether we're doing so much well, I think that's entirely open question.
So combining a few of the comments that I just heard, so if you are the main effort, you're a Green Beret, or you're over in JSOC as one of the operators, or you're a commander at one of these various levels, it seems to me like to best utilize your intelligence assets, you need to understand the pipeline, the origins, or the culture of where you're getting your intelligence folks, to understand generally where they come from, and then to try to get to know each one individually as best as possible to see where their skill sets are. Does that sound like the general path to success if you're working with intelligence enablers?
I think you're hitting it dead on. I'd make it even more specific. It just takes the commander to care. When I'm thinking about my experiences in the task force, especially towards the latter days in Afghanistan, I worked for an individual who at the time was the commander of the Ranger Regiment, and he was in charge of the task force. And the very first thing he had people brief every night, his outstations, was exploitation. That's literally the first thing he had them brief on the BTCs. And because it was important to him, it became important to the commanders. So anything that the commander thinks is important, anything the commander checks, people are going to tend to do better or be more interested in. And because he thought it was important, that made all of his subordinates care more about the intel process. Rangers always care, but now they care more because the commander's really into it. And that made us sharper and better. And it's just, again, this virtuous cycle of intel and ops working together and making each other better. So I think it starts at the top. If you have a commander that understands intel and has high expectations of the intel community, intel support, then I think you can get a lot out of them. And in regular warfare and special operations tend to have that type of commander in droves.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Charlie. So I'll leave this to either one of you to answer first. So occasionally out in the force, I'd hear things like, never trust the CIA, or the CIA will take and take and take, but they'll never give anything back. Do either of you know where those ideas originated or if they have any merit?
Yeah, so Louis, I have some strong feelings about this, and anyone who spent time in the classroom with me when we talk about this type of thing knows what I'm about to say. And I think it is largely situational dependent, and it depends on what echelon you're operating at. And I'll give a specific example here, and I'll turn it over to Dave because I imagine he's going to want to respond to this. So obviously, I have a lot of respect for the CIA. I specifically asked for Dave to be on this show with me, and I know his background. I've got friends that are in the CIA, but I had a really hard time working with the CIA downrange. And the reason was largely cultural. Without going into specifics of any organizations or things that were happening, it seemed to me that at the bottom operator level, like the folks that are out there gathering intelligence or the analysis or whatever, we get along really well. And at the upper echelon, at the top level, we got along really well. For example, Jim McChrystal would have the senior representative of the CIA sit beside him at his briefings. So we would, when we see the VTCs, you see General McChrystal, you see a sergeant major sit beside him, and then you see a senior executive from the CIA. That's how important the relationship was with him, and he wanted everybody to see it. But at middle management, where I had to live, it was a completely different story. And it was very difficult to get cooperation at that level. It was very difficult to have relationships. I felt like we were being stonewalled because our organizational mantra was share till it hurts. General McChrystal and Admiral Craven behind him, and I'm sure continue to this day, wanted to make sure that we were sharing all the information we could with anyone who could be find it of use, which was a fundamental change that I'll talk about a little bit later on in this podcast. But that was not the middle management of CIA. So I butted heads with them constantly. I really did not regard the CIA at the middle management where I had to live to be good partners with us, and I wasn't shy about sharing that. So I think some of it's personality, some of it's organizational, cultural, but it all comes back to who's going to work with us, who's willing to engage in the type of good faith that we need. So it was hard at my level, good at on the bracketing levels, but it could be better. And I think part of the problem I came to understand over time was you're in middle management, that's the most difficult place to be because you're still trying to make it. So if you're at the bottom level of the operators and analysts, you're just trying to get through the day. You're just trying to go. If you're at the top, you've already made it. But at middle management, if you want the type of cooperation that I was seeking, you have to take risks. If you're trying to get promoted, if you're really career focused, then risk isn't the way to do it. So I attribute it largely to that. So that was my biggest experience in the operation between SOF and CIA.
I mean, I've seen a lot of that, Charlie. I guess, you know, something I like to tell the DOD people is that CIA spends a lot of time fighting with itself. Everybody sometimes can just be, you know, hard to work with. You know, it's definitely not the Brady Bunch, you know, inside CIA. I think a lot of this is personality driven as well. You know, I mean, I think, people sometimes get along and there's trust and, you know, and they, or they've come through a training pipeline together or they know each other from a previous tour or deployment. And other times, you know, they just don't. I do think overall the agency and, you know, the military work well together. And of course, there's a three-star at CIA, you know, who's sort of responsible for the military integration aspects. But, you know, I think you're right. You know, at the sort of the middle management level, it's the worst. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. And I think one of them, frankly, is just, you know, you need tight operational security. And so, you know, sharing till it hurts at CIA, at least on the operational side, you know, is just not a thing that they would understand because, you know, for them, you know, the asset security or the mission security is absolutely everything. And you have to balance that, I think, because it's not really a two-way street if you've got a chief of station, because the chief of station can say, you know, no, you may not come into this country and do X, Y, Z that you want to do. And unfortunately, or otherwise, the military element has to say, you know, chapter and verse, you know, this is what I want to do. This is the flight I want to come in on. This is the car I want to rent. This is the hotel I want to stay at. This is the person I want to meet, and on and on and on. And all of those operational details are in there. And, you know, no CIA station chief or chief of operations or whomever is sort of signing off on the other end. They don't they don't, you know, sit there and try to say, how can I deny this? But I think it can feel that way sometimes, you know, on the other end, because they have a lot of stuff. There's a lot of moving pieces inside, you know, inside the station or inside the country, you know, and the worst of all possible worlds, you know, is having the military and case officers and whomever else, you know, operationally tripping over each other. And so you need to do a lot of deconfliction. The chief of station doesn't have to give a reason why you can't do something, right? Because the need to know in that situation sort of goes one way. You know, so they're not going to write back and say, well, you can't come here because we have a super sensitive meeting at this time, at this place with this person, you know? So you kind of feel, I think, on the outside. And, you know, before Charlie gets mad at me, you know, I've been on the other side of that coin. You know, I'd left CIA, but I was recalled to active duty as a J2X director, which is the chief of human intelligence and counterintelligence for East Africa. And I was responsible for 12 countries for the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa. And so I had at least 12 different chiefs of station who all hated my guts, you know, because my guys wanted to operate in that country. And, you know, and they were just like, hey, Dave, you know, it's just not worth the risk or whatever. You know, the game isn't worth the candle. The juice isn't worth the squeeze. You know, I got all of these responses back. And I kind of had this inflated sort of egotistical view that, you know, when I showed up, yeah, I'd be wearing a Navy uniform, but, you know, I was a farm grad, you know, and I kind of had the proverbial ring and, you know, I had several deployments under my belt. And I said, you know, look, I'll tell you what you want to know. And you know, think of me as a pair of hands that, you know, sort of understands what you're trying to do as well. And they were like, yeah, thanks a lot, Dave. I'll call you if I need you. And they never did, you know, because although I was formerly part of the team, I wasn't part of the team now. And that hurt, you know, but, you know, I sort of came to understand what they were trying to do. And at the end of the day, they live in those countries, whereas my guys would just be TDYing there. Why does that matter? It matters because if something goes wrong, it's not Dave Geo who's going to get, you know, called on the carpet of the host country, right? You know, I don't cash that check. The COS has to cash that check. And so that's not a fun day. And so, you know, I think it's a tough balance because it's just not an equal sort of relationship. And I think if you're an operator, you know, in particular, nobody likes to be told, you know, what you can't do. So I do think that there are tensions, but I also think that there are some sort of understandable reasons for the tensions just beyond, you know, people being difficult.
Louis, I think Dave made some excellent points now, and it's great for folks, especially folks that haven't operated in the same circles that Dave and I have over all these years to understand both of those points of view. So well said on that, Dave. And also, I want to make it clear that I don't think SOF gets it all right all the time when it comes to relationships, and certainly not in the early days of the GWAT. Louis, I know that IWI, we like to tell stories on podcasts, so I got a quick one for you. My first tour in Iraq was, I was the Group MI Detachment Commander for 5th Group, Balad, Iraq, 2004, so shortly after the war took place. And when we were building out our compound, we were by the JSOC compound, was directly adjacent to us. We shared a wall. Even though we were adjacent to each other, we were worlds apart. So I did what most young, tactically proficient captains would do. I went next door to do some adjacent unit coordination with the task force, and they wouldn't even let me in. Couldn't get in. I was like, hey, we're in the same army. We're all in soft together. I, you know, maybe there's something that my guys could do to help you out. But they wouldn't let me in, and their dismissive attitude was, there's nothing that you could possibly contribute to what we're doing here. We don't need you. So I came back to Iraq several years later after being in Afghanistan two or three times, came back, and this time I was with the task force, and there was a literal hole between the two organizations, so people could come freely back between 5th Group compound, the Siege of Soto compound, Camp Sarverson is what we called it, and the task force compound. When I came back the third time, the last time I served in Iraq, we were all sharing a JOC, a joint operations cell. So eventually we, the task force, quit being so parochial about organizations and started spreading our arms wider and encapsulating more and more people, sharing some information, getting some information back, building that team. building the network to defeat a network. And over time, we started getting it right. And my understanding is it's still that way today. So a lot less parochialism, a lot more inclusion in the force, because what we found is enablers doesn't just apply to individuals, it can apply to organizations. So I think if we take that type of mindset into anything we do in the military, SOF or not, IW or not, military or civilian, that anyone could be an enabler and we might be able to help each other. And there's possible to do win-win, even in the intel community. I think that better serves our organizations and the nation.
Charlie keeps using the word enabler. You know, an enabler at CA is someone, you know, who doesn't take away your car keys when you're drunk. You know, like there's just no, there's no sort of, you know, it's just funny, right? I mean, because they really are just worlds apart, you know. But I hesitate to get into, you know, sort of swapping stories with people like Charlie, because you're always going to lose. But I'll add one anyway. I think that, you know, the benefits of working with SOF are truly fantastic. I think sometimes CIA thinks that it's the world's most nimble bureaucracy, you know, and it sort of famously pissed off Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld for getting into Afghanistan first after 9/11. But, you know, I can recall a case, you know, overseas when I was a case officer working with Naval Special Warfare, and we had captured an Al-Qaeda facilitator and we needed a Somali linguist pretty urgently because we couldn't actually debrief the guy. And so I cabled CIA headquarters and I was like, hey, this is what I need. And they were like, fill out 51 forms and maybe we'll find somebody. And they were just really unhelpful. And I, as I said earlier at the beginning of the podcast, I was, you know, sort of the belly button with the SEAL detachment commander. And I went to him and I said, you know, hey, I need a Somali linguist. What can you do for me? And he got out this like Mac, this tough book, you know, that could be dropped from the top of a tall building and survive. So he got out his magical, you know, special operator computer system and he starts, you know, pounding away on the keyboard. And he's like, oh, okay, it says here that there's a Marine E4 who's a truck maintainer several countries away, who was born in Somalia and emigrated to Minnesota or something. But I bet you he speaks Somali. And I was like, okay, that sounds promising. And then he gets back on his tough book and he's like, oh, and I can have an airplane pick him up and bring him here by the day after tomorrow. And then he asks me with a straight face, would that be too late? Question mark. I was like, no, dude, that would be just fine. Thank you. So, you know, I think SOF has certain capabilities, you know, just to get things done. And I think there's also one, you know, that I would say in terms of downrange, SOF could debrief people. They could do certain things that CIA would require many, many, many layers of approval and lawyers, and some even, in my view, relatively basic stuff needed to be signed off on by, you know, like one of the top five people at CIA. And it was in whatever the opposite of Charlie's virtuous cycle is, where they made it so that, you know, it was important enough that it had to be signed off on by a super senior person, but at the same time, it wasn't that important. And so you could never get it on their calendar, right, or on their desk, because it actually wasn't that important. So I was sort of stalled, you know, for many days or maybe even weeks, you know, trying to do the most basic case officer functions that could not be approved by my chief of station. And anyway, so the moral of the story is, you know, I won't bore your listeners with Title 10 versus Title 50 authorities, but the long and short of it was the SEAL could basically do almost whatever he wanted if he asked the JAG at JSOC, who I think was probably a lieutenant commander, and it was an email. And he was like, you know, hey, dude, can I do XYZ? Here's the information you need. And the lawyer would come back and be like, yep, you know, sounds good, go ahead. And so we actually operated more under his authorities than under my authorities, just to get the mission done, because CIA, I think, had lost some of the nimbleness. I regret to say, you know, but I think it had lost some of the nimbleness. And so JSOC kind of became the hole filler to keep the mission going.
I think you bring up such an important point, Dave, when you talk about JAGs and the relationship with the Judge Advocate General. So my last couple of tours downrange, I did a lot with human intelligence, especially interrogation, exploitation of human detainees. And we relied on our JAGs not to rubber stamp the things that we were doing, but to make sure that we were staying in compliance, because so much of our flexibility and our ability to get the job done in the National Task Force was due to our credibility. And it always blows people's minds when they're like, oh, I bet you guys were doing all kind of this and that to your detainees. Like, no, we weren't. We were doing literally by the book, by the unclassified manual is how we did that. It's not a secret. It's how we did. We just did it better than anybody else. And we had our JAGs right there with us all the way. And I'll name one guy. I'll call him Joe because that was his name that worked with us. And Joe was a very successful JAG. Would not rubber stamp us, but normally would find a way to get to yes. And if he ever told us no, then we knew it was for a good reason. So if you're operating in the intel community, it's essential, especially in soft, to have a JAG that really understands how to get to yes and how to say no. So that's just a shout out to the Judge Advocate Generals and the way that they enable intel.
So they are also enablers, Charlie. Is this what you're telling me?
100%. In every sense of the definition that we talked about in this show today, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you both. So, Dave, a bit of a pivot towards the future on this one in regards to some of your recent articles and work with Great Power Cyber Competition. You've written that regardless of improvements in signals intelligence, open source intelligence, or other intelligence capabilities, human intelligence will always be necessary. Can you explain your perspective on that to our audience?
Yeah, I think we need to stop writing the human obituary. I've read so many, you know, human obituaries. I should start keeping a little scrapbook collection. You know, now we just need to hack for everything. And these things keep coming up. And I think it's just wrong for several reasons. I think we're always going to need humans. The other ints are great. I don't want to take anything away from them. The GeoInt people are great. The NSA wizards, you know, are great. I do think there's a bit of a SIGINT bias that's kind of built into the DoD and I think the policy community, because there's a sort of this perception that like, well, that's firsthand, you know? So you could have two people who are totally uninformed. Like you could have two QAnon conspiracy theorists, you know, and we capture that SIGINT cut and then people are like, oh, look here, it's true. It's, you know, it's firsthand. And so I think sometimes we kind of don't understand, some of the limitations of some of the other ints. And also, I think the ways in which we try to ameliorate, you know, human, because you always hear, well, you know, they're humans and they're lying and they're just doing it for the money or they have an agenda or whatever. And those things might be true, but case officers are trained to deal with bias, to get through people's, you know, sort of axes that they're trying to grind. You can deal with falsification by trying to verify, you know, and cross-check other sources. Right? That agent can build up a record of reporting accuracy. And so, you know, just sort of dismissing humans, you know, as kind of classified gossip, you know, I've heard one too many times, I think it does humans a disservice. And I think it also does the analysts a disservice. Well, it does the case officers a disservice, because we're not just writing down, we're not human tape recorders. Like we're not writing down everything the person is saying, right? You know, we take our notes, we probe, we question, we ask the same question a couple different times, right? We really try to make sure that we have a coherent story. And then the collection management officers help us make sure that what we're reporting actually is pegged to an intelligence requirement. And then the analysts, they're not robots either, right? Like they're not AI, they're not ChatGPT. So they see what comes in and they read the context statement and they go, well, this person has an interest in this, or the person has a bias about that. And the analysts take all that into consideration. At the end of the day, cyber ops are great. What happens if, you know, let's take Putin as an example, right? You know, I don't think he's not Doogie Howser, right? He doesn't keep a digital diary, you know, at the end of every day, you know, dear diary, tomorrow I plan to invade Ukraine, right? And so we don't just, you know, you can't just hack into that. And so you need people in the inner circle, right? The famous Bin Laden courier, not that he was a recruited agent, but the point is, you know, that it's ultimately a human thing. The other thing you hear a lot is, well, you know, cyber can do so much, and it's true, but here's another dissertation topic for you. Humans and cyber, I think, interact synergistically, because you can have human-enabled cyber operations, right? Think Stuxnet. How else are you going to get a virus onto a closed system, right? You need a human being, right, to actually insert that virus. And then, of course, you know, the other way around, you know, you can have cyber-enabled human operations as well. And so I think we need to focus more on the synergistic effects between human and the other ints and stop trying to like rank order ints, like they're bronze, silver, and gold.
We're going to go ahead and wrap up. As much as I've enjoyed this conversation and don't really want it to end, we'll wrap up with just a couple closing questions. So Charlie, real quick with you. So what are some key ideas that you wish IC partners understood about working with soft personnel?
So I think this is a compound question that I'll answer as briefly as possible. So when IC is dealing with SOF, I think first of all, the people that are dealing with SOF need to get over the imposter syndrome. I remember my first times engaging with SOF personnel when I was not SOF myself, thinking that they know all the answers, they have all the equipment, they can do everything. That's not the case. So SOF is extremely capable, but I think non-SOF personnel and SOF personnel need to remember the fifth SOF truth, which no one likes to talk about, which is most special operations require enabling from non-SOF organizations. So we're all in this together, and we should all think, who needs to know, who can help me, and who can I help? And if folks from outside the SOF community keep that in mind, and the SOF community, I think we'll get along really well. The last bit I'll have, Julia, is for people that are enablers in SOF. If you want the SOF guys to respect you, if you want to be included on missions, if you want to do all these cool things that Dave and I have been talking about, you need to be good at your job and don't try to be good at their job. So if you're in a special forces unit, you're an enabler. Go be great at enabling. Let the ops guys do ops stuff. And that's how you get their respect. That's how you get asked out on missions. And that's how you ensure that Intel always has a seat at the table. So thank you, Julia.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I can relate to what you're saying. And I know many of our audience members will as well. So for both of you, this is our final question. What are the implications from today's discussion for policymakers, practitioners, and academics working on irregular warfare?
So, yeah, Julie, this is a great question. So when we talk about implications, I was thinking during our discussion today, a lot of what Dave and I have been saying is not new. If we look back at my father or anyone else who spent a lot of time in Intel community before, I think we find a lot of the same problems and the same solutions. So what we're experiencing in the SOF community and in the IC is more a phenomenon of lessons observed versus lessons learned. So I think one of the reasons that what IWI is doing is so important is because podcasts like yours help reach the people that are making these decisions or will be making them down the road. So when I think about implications for practitioners and academics is that we're all in this together. We need to find a way to work together. We need to understand the cultures and the cultural differences. And as Dave mentioned, the organizational responsibilities and interests that go into it. Spend some time about your own profession and the other organizations you work with and bring that to the table. When you're at the table, if you're in the room and at the table, regardless of who you're there with, you're there for a reason. So stand up, be an advocate for your profession, for the Intel community. Be able to provide something good to the people that you're supporting. And make sure that you're being as inclusive as possible in terms of bringing all those assets to bear, thinking about who could benefit from the information, who can help, and who needs it. And I think that will make policy, practice, and academia better. Thank you.
Well, that's going to be hard to follow. And I guess I only have a couple of things to add. You know, I think the first one is that the last 20 years or so of the GWAT has been a sort of out-of-body experience for CIA. You know, I think, you know, JSOC was sort of like tailor-made for the GWAT. You know, like it was just, you know, it was the right tool for the job. And CIA, I think to its great credit, tried to become the right tool for the job. It had to, you know, because there's, you know, young Americans in harm's way. And so, you know, I think CIA became, in the words of former CIA Inspector General Fred Hitz, he said it became predator-centric and military-focused or something like that. And I think that was true. And there are good reasons why it did what it did, to try to support the national interest, right? And ultimately, you know, that's what the National Command Authority needed. But, you know, it sort of got very tactical and very militarized. And I think we were sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul for maybe 20 years or so. And now I think, you know, we have the opportunity to kind of get back to the classic. You know, I don't know if SOF is made for great power competition. And, you know, I know there's a lot of thinking and writing about, you know, they were amazing at the GWAT, but, you know, now what's the next step? Whereas it's the opposite for CIA. CIA wasn't made for the GWAT. You know, now it's going back to, you know, great power competition, to Russia, China, you know, that's its, you know, sort of bread and butter. And so I think actually, you know, they're in a good place, but there's a lot of tradecraft that has to get unlearned as well. You know, war zone tradecraft is not real tradecraft. And so I think the junior officers who kind of came up, you know, serving, you know, in the war zones now need to kind of, you know, get back to the classical bits. I also wanted to say something, I guess, briefly, you know, for the practitioners out there, you know, especially for the analysts, because good analysts can make sense of a lot of information, but great analysts can actually drive operations to figure out the information that they need and then to, you know, sort of task the machinery to go get it, you know? And so you see analysts sometimes being, well, I wish I had this or I wish I had that, you know, find a way to task the machinery to get what you need. A good analyst can really drive their own collection requirement. And I didn't do that well as an analyst, you know, and looking back, I think I could have done that a lot better. And then finally, I'd like to quote a friend of special operations, David Oakley, who's called the shift from intelligence to enable action, which I think we saw over the GWAT period, to intelligence to enable understanding. And I think that's going to be the real key moving forward, right? Intelligence is not a crystal ball. It's sense-making most of the time because it's a complex world. And I think we can also do a good job to demystify intelligence. I think people fear what they don't understand. And so I think there's a lot of suspicion in the United States about, you know, what are these intelligence people and what are they doing? And that's why I do what I do, you know, is to speak, go on podcasts, write, teach. Those are important to me because I think we need to reconnect. You know, special forces are, you know, sort of, they're always the good guys and the heroes, and that's great. And they are, but the intel people are as well. And sometimes I think they've been getting some bad press recently as the kind of, you know, the deep state or whatever. And I think we need to do stuff like, you know, like IWI and podcasts, because we think we need to tell our own story, because I don't think anybody's going to tell it for us if we don't. And the days of, you know, no comment, or, you know, I could tell you, or I have to kill you, you know, all that kind of stuff doesn't wash, you know, with young people anymore. It doesn't wash with observers. And I think we need to kind of get out there, and instead of being reactive, you know, reactive transparency to leaks or bad press or whatever, I think we need to sort of have a positive message to get out there and explain, as we did today, you know, what is special operations? What is intelligence? Where do they overlap? And by demystifying it and helping people understand, they'll then have confidence in it. And it's only through that confidence in a democratic system that we then get the authorities that we need to go back out and keep the American people safe.
Thank you both so much for joining us on the Irregular Warfare Podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here with us.
Thanks, friends.
Thank you both very much. And thanks, Charlie, for the invitation.
Thank you again for joining us for episode 104 of the Irregular Warfare Podcast. We release a new episode every 2 weeks. In the next episode, Ben and Nathan talk to Dr. Alexandra Tinchilla and Colonel Justin Huffnagel to discuss security force assistance in Ukraine. After that, Matt and I talk to Vice Admiral Mark Montgomery and Kurt Sanger about the idea of U.S. cyber force as a separate military branch.
Be sure to subscribe to Irregular Warfare Podcast so you don't miss an episode. The podcast is a product of the Irregular Warfare Initiative. We are a team of all-volunteer practitioners and researchers dedicated to bridging the gap between scholars and practitioners to support the community of irregular warfare professionals. You can follow and engage with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, or LinkedIn. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter for access to our content and upcoming community events. The newsletter sign-up is found at irregularwarfare.org.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave a comment and positive rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the Irregular Warfare Podcast. It really helps expose the show to new listeners. And one last note, all that you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and do not represent those at Princeton, West Point, or any agency of the United States government.
Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.